Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Weiser, the owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host, site designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey there.
And our returning guest from Arkane Games, lead designer and owner, Chris Park.
Hey!
Alright, so for those of you who don't know, Chris just released their latest game, A Valley Without Wind 2, last week. And this has been in development, I believe, did you start developing this during A Valley Without Wind 1 or after, during the post-content support?
After doing the post-content support, so it's really been in development since August. But in terms of design, it's one of those things that kind of stretches back into Valley Without Wind 1 because we've been queuing up ideas for things that we wanted to do differently, but that we couldn't without changing A Valley Without Wind 1 too much. And so, you know, and there's a lot of Valley Without Wind 1 engine stuff that lives in Valley Without Wind 2, like with most sequels. So, you know, the what you would normally call the development cycle started in August.
Okay. Now, for those of you who haven't been following, Valley Without Wind 2 is special in the fact that it was given out free to everyone who purchased A Valley Without Wind 1. Chris, could you talk a little bit about that for those who haven't been following the game's development at all?
Sure. Well, with Valley Without Wind 1, it was a very exploratory sort of game. We spent a lot of time doing basically what you would refer to, I guess, as R&D, where we would try different things, see what worked best, and narrow things down. And the resulting product at the end of that was something that a lot of people found really fun, and I thought was really fun, but it's very, you know, niche, and it's very, you know, for a lot of people, kind of an acquired taste. And so we took, in the press in particular, kind of a beating with that. That was something that, you know, certain outlets really received the game well, and then other outlets really didn't. And so we wound up at the end of the day with a Metacritic score of like 54, and which is really uncharacteristically low for us. I mean, yeah, normally the Arkane titles are in, like, I think our lowest before that was like 79, and we have like 79 to 82. And so that was a bit of a surprise, but it's kind of one of those things where you had to really get into the game, take a while to get into it, and then you would start to see what was cool about it. And a lot of bigger reviewers in particular didn't want to do that. They, you know, clearly spent just a couple hours with it and didn't really get it. And then, you know, and anyway, as I said, niche and acquired taste anyhow. So we decided we wanted to do something dramatically different, especially with all that we learned during the R&D period. And so we said, all right, we went through a number of iterations. At first, we thought it was just going to be an art revamp. But then we thought, okay, well, let's just do a completely different thing, you know, based on what we've learned and what we want to do now. And, you know, we really wanted to avoid like a Left 4 Dead 2 sort of situation where, you know, the game came out so shortly after the first one and everybody gets all pissed off because they expected better support on the first one and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And that was something that, especially with the first one not being all that well received by the press, even though a lot of players seemed to like it, that was something we really wanted to avoid, was anybody having a bad taste in their mouth of feeling like they'd been ripped off or whatever. So we said, okay, forget about all that. We're just going to do the second game that we want to do. We're just going to give it to them for free. The people have already bought it. They support us. They're making the second game possible in the first place. So, you know, there's no way that anybody can reasonably complain, oh, goodness, you're, you know, not supporting me properly because I thought you were going to do more support on the first one when you switch to the sequel and you give it to me for free. And, you know, so you still get some people that complain amazingly, but that's, you know, I said reasonably, so.
I think what you were talking about with the reviews, I think one part that did hurt A Valley Without Wind 1 a little bit was how much change you actually did to it after the release. I remember You change progression system around a lot. You add in, I guess, I think it was like randomized spells at one point.
Yep.
So, I mean, even from like beta to launch and then launch to post content, the game radically changed. And I think a lot of the people who reviewed it probably only play like the first week and, you know, threw the score up right then and there.
Yeah, there was that. And, you know, we launched with too few monsters in Valley 1 was one of the issues as well. And, you know, we went as far as we could with that. We drove it until we had negative $6,000, basically, in terms of company funds. And it had to go out. And it's not that we released it in an unfinished state, but it's one of those games where, like Minecraft or something, I mean, they went at some point where they said, okay, this is done. You know, this is 1.0, but then they kept going because it's just kind of a, you know, those open world sandboxy sort of games, they tend to be something that, if there's player interest, can be perpetually upgraded. And as we getting more and more playtesting feedback and more of this and that and the other, we kept improving it in large material ways. And people that reviewed it at the start, as you say, didn't get the benefit of any of those things. And we'd hoped for some re-reviews. We did 3 months of heavy, heavy post-release content that did a lot of improvements to the game, but then, you know, that window was closed. We already had the Metacritic score on the earlier version of the game, and that ship had basically sailed. And so, you know, doing a sequel was a way for us to kind of, you know, get another round at the press in terms of getting a whole new Metacritic score and, you know, having a whole new art that we could actually afford to do nice art this time around. And, you know, this one is not a sandbox at all. So it's, you know, one really radical departure from the first one. It's a, you know, it is done, it is complete at this point. There's little tweaks and stuff that we're doing, but it's not going to evolve heavily unless we do an expansion.
Yeah. I think that's interesting, the point about re-reviews, because Valley Without Wind 1 isn't the first game that I played that saw massive revisions following post-content. I remember with Supreme Commander 2, they did a lot of work after its release to update the AI, which was one of the biggest complaints about it.
Right.
And even that game didn't get a re-review. I think it's been like a few years, but I actually wrote a blog post regarding that, if it would be prudent for game reviewers to re-review titles. And it always seems to be a tricky concept, because you always run into that double-edged sort of, you know, on one hand, it's great that it gets new people into it, but on the other hand, it's sort of, they may sort of rub the original fans the wrong way. They got the game, you know, in the watered-down or, you know, not correct state, and now the game's, you know, all shiny, flashy, and new, you know, 2-3 months down the line.
And that's a valid point, but I guess it's kind of like World of Warcraft or something. I mean, with MMOs, they've got a section in a lot of magazines now where it's like the current state of these. And, you know, World of Warcraft is vastly better as a game now, you know, than it was at launch. That they rushed it to launch, or that it was broken at launch, or whatever. It's only watered down as compared to it is now. And, you know, there's material defects at launch. That's always something that is unfortunate, one way or the other. But that's really kind of neither here nor there in terms of whether you see it fixed as a consumer. And, you know, if, from a game developer's standpoint, there's a massive investment into a game, any game, before it comes out. And if it's off in some subtle ways that you just don't learn about until a large audience gets their hands on it, which sometimes happens, then that is something that would be nice to have a chance to fix, and then, you know, basically let the record reflect it. But on the other end, you've got reviewers that are already bogged down with so many games to review, and if they had to re-review every, you know, game that they do every you know, couple of months or something, it would be ridiculous. But I mean, you know, probably one of the more dramatic examples I can think of is like Sword of the Stars, which was really not well received at first, and then, you know, really turned itself around later, and I have no idea how that impacted its sales, But I don't know. It's a tricky thing, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
I know that Final Fantasy XIV, its reviews were so, you know, was pandered so hard that they actually fired their entire staff and they lose the entire game as something new,
right,
called Realm Reborn. It was very interesting. And I think that is a second game, but they need to make it clear that it is another game, not the same game.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it Final Fantasy XIV if I was them.
Yeah, I mean, they should just call it Final Fantasy Realm Reborn. That would have been fine, right?
And it's, game to review. It's tricky, too, because, I mean, that's an MMO, so at least they're going to get a re-review from most places. Plus, also, it's Squaresoft. They have muscle that, you know, you know, gas-powered games or ourselves or, you know, Stardock just don't have. So that's...
Right, but it was just... Well, that's the interesting thing. There's such a... They usually never say sorry for their mistakes. So for them to actually admit that this game was flawed and then redo the whole thing seems that they're probably putting more investment on their audience finally, you know? Because right now they're kind of like dwindling in terms of the eyes of more of the hardcore gamers.
Yeah. I mean, they've had kind of a rough run of it, haven't they, with 13 and 14. Mm. And, you know, it's... I don't know. There's some cultural mindset stuff between Japanese companies and, you know, I mean, just with anything, there's a difference between, you know, American and British companies too.
Yeah.
But there's some emphasis on not making and then potentially by extension not admitting mistakes with some of the Japanese companies. But that's something that really seems to be changing, which I think is really cool. Because, I mean, if you look at like Sony too, they're doing things a bit differently now with kind of apologizing for some stuff on the PS3 and, you know, during their launch for the PS4. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they're finally admitting that the cell was not the way to go and they should have offered more support. And, you know, their new system's going to integrate, you know, PC architecture.
And that's one of those things, too. It's not like they intended to screw stuff up with the cell, or it's not like the cell was, you know, obviously a bad idea when they did it, but it was something that they learned over time. Nope, that was a bad idea, you know. And at that point, then, you know, it's hardware. You can't revise that. So, you know, it's PlayStation 4. You know, they made the best of it while they had it. But you know, it's tricky. For me, I just try and be upfront with players and that at the end of the day, I think, is all that can really be done.
I think that always gives you more respect, and that's what you kind of want, create a relationship of trust
absolutely
with your audience and fans.
Absolutely.
And we definitely saw that last month with the Wildman Kickstarter, when Chris Taylor, you know, basically poured his heart out on the screen to talk about the fact that he had to let go of the entire company just to, you know, try to keep the Kickstarter alive at that point.
Oh, man. I missed that.
You didn't see that? You should definitely check it again. It's a very heartbreaking video to watch. Because you can really see the rawness in the man. Talk about how he's putting everything on the line for this Kickstarter. And that he had to let go of some great people. So, and, you know, he'd been in the industry for so long, too. Yeah. Having to do that is just...
Yeah.
You can't fathom.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, no, crazy time. All right, let's talk a little bit about A Valley Without Wind 2's design. Now, when we last spoke on the previous podcast, you talked about a lot of how A Valley Without Wind, it got away from you guys, which is how big and just how, I guess, unruly like the design got. So there's a lot of different systems, a lot of different mission types in the game. With A Valley Without Wind 2, was this sort of what you were aiming for with the original Valley, or was this something that was basically a birth while you were redesigning A Valley Without Wind 1?
A little bit of both. In terms of, you know, the spirit of what we were going for when we started out working on Valley 1, this is definitely closer. You know, we knew that we wanted a game that had a heavy strategic part, and it had tactical combat, and those were kind of our two big things. And we really got away from that and suddenly had all this like missions-based stuff and not really much in the way of strategic stuff, all this crafting and other mechanics and so on that came up during Valley 1. And so all those things wound up kind of taking center stage in Valley 1, and we're like, okay, wait a second, let's get back to what we were originally trying to do here with Valley 2. But at the same time, when we sat down to do the redesign for Valley 2, there were a lot of things that we had learned during the process of making Valley 1, things that worked, things that didn't work, etc. And so there were a number of things that we thought to do at the time of the redesign for Valley 2 that we would thought to do if we hadn't gone through that whole process of Valley 1. So it's kind of a, you know, Valley 1 prepared us to better execute on our original ideas in ways that we wouldn't have been able to think of at the time of.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, with the Valley Without Wind 2, did it, once you figure out the design, did it ever get as unruly in any area like the Valley Without Wind 1, or did it stay pretty in control for the remainder of the development?
It stayed pretty much in control. The two areas that got a little bit out of hand, and that was just a matter of, they were that way from the, but it was more work than had been intended, was the fact that we put in around 125, I think it is, enemies in the game, 200 spells. And any way you cut it, takes a long time to implement. Yes. And those things... those things wound up taking longer than intended to implement, but there was remarkably little change from our original design document for the sequel. So we wound up, you know, redoing the strategic game a number of times during beta, you know, refining various things about how you moved your guys around and so forth. But the core concept behind it is the same, and it was just refinements on that concept, not wholesale new concepts. And the enemies and so forth, you know, those went through essentially four drafts on each enemy, and the final drafts were often pretty different from what the original drafts or even the third draft was. But that was something where those came out far, far stronger than the original designs were. And that's just, you know, a case of, you know, in the moment, creativity over a span of weeks or a month is so much stronger than, you know, creativity in advance, you know, over days or even weeks when you're working on a design document. There's just, you know, but the design document helps, you know.
One area that I really do like about Valley Without Wind 2 is just how different in design it is from other games. You have this. It sort of reminds me of AI Wars and how you're basically fighting an asymmetrical battle between the AI. But you have this sense the character is basically fighting you as time goes on. During Weekend, I was checking out the game list. I got to the point where Demonica, is that how you...
Demoniaca.
Demoniaca. I'm not going to pronounce that properly on this game. he starts basically coming out and doing his damage. Now... when we last spoke how the original design was inspired by ActRaiser, with this time, with this whole element of you competing with this, what inspired you to basically add this whole system to the design?
Well, ActRaiser is still a big inspiration for this, and then we had the idea to build in subsystems with survivors based on the game Rebuild. Because that's something that I think is really cool. And we said, let's, you know, there's no other game remotely like Rebuild. Wonder if we did something, you know, vaguely in that neighborhood without it being something that would on their toes. I mean, Sarah Northway did a wonderful job, and she should, you know, everybody needs to come swoop in and take that from her. That's something that kind of inspired, you know, how you move the survivors around and how we have this kind of isometric view where there's scavenging and some of the other things. And then it just kind of evolved from there. It was a matter of we wanted you to feel that this big bad guy, Monica, is a bad guy. You know, we're not going to tell, hey, there's a bad guy, and you won't see him for another until the end of the game, but he's out there, trust us, and you totally should get strong and go get him. You know, we wanted you to hate him actively. where, you know, it's like, that is the guy. He's the one. He's been doing it this whole time. Not his legions, not his minions, him personally. And so, you know, that was kind of the goal that led to us having this kind of, as some people have characterized, invincible steamroller that comes out and just absolutely wrecks stuff for a while. And he comes out on turn 14. Most games tend to last 50 to 70 turns, depending on exactly, you know, how long you spend, how efficient you are, basically. And it's just kind of getting going when he comes out, because basically everything before that is kind of the early game where you're just kind of prepping stuff for when he comes out. And his arrival is kind of the beginning of middle game, and that goes on for a while, and then there's a separate end game where things are winding down. And, you know, in this beginning, middle, and end games of chess, which is always my kind of ultimate example of anything game-related.
speaking about beginning, middle, and end game, I think that's another area that differentiates about win 1 from 2. In the first game, it is essentially procedurally generated. It could effectively go on once a player wanted to. But this time, there is an actual beginning, middle, and end to it. Now, was that a major decision that you guys had to make to basically limit the time spent playing number 2 compared to the first one?
That was one of the things that we realized pretty quickly during, well, I wouldn't say pretty quickly, but in the middle of the beta of Valley 1, which is actually like 15 probably months after starting working on that game. So not pretty quickly, but at that particular point, we were going, oh, Lord, what did we sign ourselves up for with this infinite world thing? This is really draining us in all sorts of unpleasant ways. And the infinite world thing makes it so that there's no satisfactory conclusion. I really like that with Minecraft or something where you're kind of, it's not really a game, it's just a place that you go, and there's things that you do that are fun, and you construct things and all that, but it's not a traditional game with a traditional game arc, and that you know, you lose some certain kinds of emotional connection with that. You don't have, say, the same emotional arc in Minecraft that you get from a, you know, a good Final Fantasy game, or, you know, a Castlevania game or something like that. Yeah. There's a different emotional connection of the attachments you created, and, you know, attachment to this world that you've been in for such a long time with Minecraft. But with Valley 1, a lot of that sort of thing was lost because you're not really creating anything that's permanent, because you have to go, you know, if you're going to have an adventure game, you have to keep going outwards into areas that aren't conquered yet. And there's also that thing of there's no real incentive to stay back where you had been, because, again, you're constantly moving forward and moving outwards. And so, you know, really all that we wind up creating is disk and RAM problems with making it an infinite, because there's no real incentive to stay where you are, and so you're constantly going out, so the world just grows indefinitely, and by the time that you are, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 continents in, it's taking way, way longer to save your... Not save is not too big a deal, because it saves component-wise and stuff, but if you want to back up your world, then that's gets way slower. And, you know, with Minecraft, you don't run into that problem because the players are so restricted in how fast they move, and there's a lot of reward for staying in, you know, mostly one area. You're not, you know, you're not wandering the entire Minecraft world. Usually, you're not trying to do that. You're trying to create something awesome wherever you are. Mm-hmm. And then you go a little further and you create something awesome there. So it's just kind of an interesting thing. That was one thing that was like at the top of our list of things we would want to do differently. But that was a great example of something that we couldn't just change in Valley 1, that would just destroy that game. And it was the sort of thing that if we made so many changes that were that severe to Valley 1, the people who really loved Valley 1, that would just be such a cause for outcry. And it would just effectively kind of erase Valley 1. Yeah. It would just kind of patch it out of existence. And we didn't want to do that either. So this way, you know, Valley 1 exists. It's its own thing. It's cool for what it is. And some people prefer it. I don't, but I think it's really cool anyway. And Valley 2, I much prefer, and is really different without stomping out the first one.
And speaking about having that connection to the characters, both games have a fairly interesting story. We talked about on the last podcast about how it takes place in this world that reality has shattered, you know, time periods are, you know, squeezed in together. And with Battlefield 1 2, we have this different story of, you know, you have the big bad guy, you're essentially like a double agent for the big bad guy at the start. And you really do get that greater sense of connection to the characters, to the world, when you are limited in what you can and can't do. Unlike in the first game where, you know, it's just the world just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right. It's a lot of the same sort of tropes and stuff, but it's so much more personal. And we were able to actually make real backstory for the bad guy and his henchmen and so forth and so on, and even your character. Versus in the first game, you know, there were overlords there too, but, you know, you'd fight one, you'd kill one every 10 hours or so. And so there's a limit to what we can do if they're kind of procedurally generated. We could have done more than we did, but I still don't think it would have resulted in a, you know, we were looking at stuff like that, and we were just like, we can keep flying Band-Aids to try and make it do, have that kind of emotional arc, but it's just, that's not what that game is about. It's too sandboxy. And with two, we're like, okay, let's do this the way we would if this, if you take away the sandbox assumptions.
Mm-hmm. Now, the progression with A Valley Without Wind 2, it does feel a bit different from the first one. In this one, you're definitely more focused on where you have to go with the different level-up towers with the robotics facility. What led to the change in, I guess, narrowing the progression down?
Really trying to tie the strategic game and the side view game together so that, you know, every time you go on a little mission into a region, you know, that's what clears the surrounding regions in that region on the world map so that you can then go further. So as you're doing side view exploration, that's also doing world map exploration. And there are world map goals about, like, you know, amplifier towers or whatever that let you do a big burst of exploration, or bell towers, which lets you pull Demoniaca and his monsters away from whatever it is they'd normally be stomping on, or, you know, just other various special tiles out there that are strategic game-focused. But then there's these adventure game-focused things, like the level-up towers and the robotics facilities. There's four of those, actually, and things of that nature. So you have this kind of little bit of a war going on between your different goals. There's, you know, things that will pump up your character in the side view versus things that will help your survivors in the strategic view. And sometimes you have to kind of choose between those temporarily before you can really get everything accomplished. And maybe you have to forego that level up tower for a few turns because Demoniaca is just rampaging around, and he's going to kill your dudes if you stay in that part of the map. Mm-hmm. And it's not a if he's going to kill your dudes, it's a certainty. And that's what really changes once you get to the middle game. During the early game, you know, there's some monsters that come after you, but you can take those out fairly straightforwardly. And in the middle game, monsters still continue to come after you, but and so those are one thing you have to deal with, but you have the invincible Demoniaca, and when he's coming, you're a lot faster than him, so you can get away, but you have to actually get away. You can't just stay there, and he's also going to stomp your buildings, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't rebuild. You can't you know, it's just a matter of time till he gets everything. So you have to keep finding new places to build buildings and all that sort of thing. So that whole progression is really weird for a game. There's nothing, no other game I've ever played that has that sort of progression. Mm-hmm. And we kind of backed into that, and I thought it was a really cool thing. But that is the focus of the game, that sort of thing of what am I going to do versus what is Demoniac going to do. And, you know, during the early part of the game, which it sounds like is mostly what you've played, the kid gloves are really off because Demoniac is not out there. So you're kind of free to just kind of pursue whatever's in front of you, and there's not a whole lot of tension with that. But once he comes out, and the longer he stays out, the more everything changes, where it's just like... Just because a level up tower is one turn away doesn't mean you're going to be getting it anytime soon. if things are, if, you know, if he's causing trouble and you have to, you know, get your survivors out of a bind. And, that is where it's got kind of a strategy game flow. And so that's where the flow of the game comes from, during the middle game in particular. And, to that end, that makes it so that you can't just wander wherever, or you know, it becomes more give and take, and so it's not really what I would call directed. Once you get past the early stages, it's just it has that give and take stroke of a strategy game. You can't always do what you want to do because sometimes you're reacting to the enemy, and sometimes you put the enemy in the defensive, so you have a quick while he's on the defensive, let me do really quick what I want to do, and then. And then he's back on the offensive again, and then you know, have to react to him again. So this is kind of a back and forth. You know, we made a long early game period so that people could kind of get established and not be rushed immediately with Demonica coming out and just wreaking havoc on their game, which is what happened before, where a lot of times people were, you know, dead by turn 12 during the beta because he would come out on turn 5 or 6. They wouldn't be adequately prepared. They didn't know exactly how to get away from him, and there wasn't too terribly much space. So it's kind of a cage match. They would just, you know, if they didn't know in advance of him coming out what to do, he'd kill them, and that'd be the end of that. Versus now when he comes out on turn 14, death's, you know, in the turn 20s or whatever is a lot less likely because you actually have room to maneuver and you've kind of got a buffer of food. You know, in the early game, you're used to having farms and things like that, producing a bunch of food. It's like, hooray, I've got like almost 1,000 food or something. And then he comes out and smashes all those farms and suddenly you're in debt every turn because you are scavenging not enough food. And you're like, I need to do some farms, but I don't have enough scrap. And, oh, my God, here he comes. Where am I going to build a farm that he's not just going to knock it down anyway? So there's this whole, again, like I said, the kind of give and take. And you've got all of those sort of concerns to manage all of a sudden. Anyway, that's a long answer to your original question. But it subordinates the progression of the side view to the progression of the strategic game. And that's really what the simple answer, I guess, is to your question.
Now, with like moving the follows around, one thing that I couldn't really figure out was what determines movement radius for each one of your followers. Is it by class or by power?
Yeah, it's by class, and the power is their strength in battle. Okay. And so, like skirmishers move kind of like an average amount. I forget what it is exactly. It's like I think, and then the soldiers move a lot less. It's like I want to say, and then the scouts really, really fast, but they have very little health. And there's detailed documentation in the game, but it's one of those things where there's a, you know, limited amount to kind of force feed the player before they start having engine issues.
Yep, I think where I'm at in my game, first icon was. I captured, I think, 3 Robux of facilities. I found his 2, like those 2, like, structures you have to go in to weaken him. And he was already out, just, like, wiping the floor with all my guys. I had a few guys, like, trapped, like, a little corner where he's, like, slowly coming in and lightning storms happening.
Just, like, yeah, once he starts coming in, it's kind of like, let him get close and then run past. So it's like you're further into the middle game than I thought, or else you got lucky on that seed in terms of what it put in there. How many level up towers did you get, roughly?
I think I was at 10 or 11 the last time.
Okay, cool. So yeah, you were 16 total levels, and once you get level 12, you can technically eat the game at that point. So you're actually about 3/4 of the way through the middle game then at that point, it sounds like. And so yeah, you got a good view of it.
Yeah. I got on luck with how all the towers are just like stretched like way across them. When I was looking at Ken, he was like screen sharing it. Well, it's like he had like 2 level towers like all in Purify turn 1. Like, how the hell did you get that?
There's a lot of, in terms of some of that thing, in terms of right at start, so he's going to have kind of an easier start, but what that probably does mean is that it'll even out, you know, turn 15 or so by the time, you know, because the fact that they're there, yeah, not somewhere else.
Now, I do have a few run by with Valley Without Wind 2.
Sure.
And these are a few things I talked about in my analysis that, for those of you listening, I'll have a link to a podcast. One thing I think is a little point to me is that there seems a general disconnect between the between the side world and the overworld game. Like, I was kind of hoping for a little bit more. The example that I was talking about was like with how you send your guys out, like your followers are influenced by what you bring back. Your strategy are influenced by your followers between those systems there. With Evaluation 2, it kind of seems like your followers don't really have that big of an impact on the side outside of basically blocking through an impasse or stuff like that. Are there going to plan to, I guess, add more between these two systems in like future content?
Definitely 100% no. There's an extremely, extremely good reason for that. That was actually a core design decision made with this. With XCOM, that's a little bit of a different situation because that is a turn-based tactics game on the, you know, all the way through down there. I haven't actually played that, so I'm going based on my understanding, based on having read about it. So I may say something really incorrect about XCOM, and correct me if I do.
Okay.
But my understanding is that it's turn-based all the way through, and that's, you know, I have played, like, you know, Empire, Total War, or something like that, and those, you know, where they've got a strategic portion and a turn-based strategic portion and a real-time tactics portion. And the difference with something like that is there's no way to grind. There's no way that you can just, like, go into the real-time tactics portion and just grind, and suddenly the strategic portion is absolutely trivial. And if we're going to have a real strategic game that actually matters, then what that means is you have to make it so that anything your player does in side view can never help the strategic game, because otherwise you are... basically saying, all right, well, we're running short on, good example, we're running short on food on the side view. Maybe my guy can go gather food. Well, that just basically means that all food is a time tax for you. So anytime you get running low on food, the game is not balanced properly, that you actually have to manage your food properly. It wouldn't have to be balanced properly. You would just say, oh man, food is running low again. I guess I'm going to have to run around in some grassland areas and, you know, kill some cows or something to get some food and bring back my survivors. And there's no strategy in that. There's just, you know, the game asking you to waste 45 minutes going and doing some trivial activities for a while. And that right there, if you want to boil down my arguments against a lot of the free-to-play models, that is it right there, is that when you can buy currency, for instance, to just bypass parts of the game, and in fact, there's an incentive for developers to kind of poorly balance the game so that you feel the pressure to buy some currency every so often, that is something where you wind up with a core game that doesn't stand on its own if you're not buying currency. It's not well balanced. It's maybe well balanced to make you buy currency, which is the goal, but it's not well balanced as a game. And then, you know, if you're willing to spend X amount of money, then you are willing to have a completely unbalanced game in the other direction where everything is just absolutely trivial and you just blaze through things. And it really becomes just kind of a, you know, Pavlovian sort of situation. And if you replace money with players' time, that's kind of what you wind up with in a strategy game where your direct avatar can grind for stuff. And so that's why we don't have a connection from the adventure side to the strategy side, is because that would completely undermine the strategy game. Mm-hmm. The reason we don't have more of a connection back the other way is because with the strategy game, it's reasonably complicated as it is, just to try and manage everything that is going on. And you can see on the board the state of everything. That was something that we really wanted to do, is, you know, you can see where your survivors are, what their powers are, you know, all your resources are right there on the side view. So you're not having to go into endless menus and so on trying to figure out, what is the state of my world? And if the survivors are having detailed impacts on the side view as well, then that's something that multiplies the complexity enormously for the player, of like, well, should I use them for this on the strategic view, or should I use them for the side view? And that makes it so that one of two things happens. Either you've got a situation where the side view is balanced appropriately for itself, and you don't really need the help of the strategic survivors. And if you use the strategic survivors to help on the side view, then you're kind of trivializing it. Mm-hmm. Or it's not balanced properly without having the strategic guys helping, which means that in order for you to succeed at the side view, you have to also be succeeding at the strategic game above and beyond what it's already asking you to succeed at. And that is something where that kind of gets in the way of having independent difficulty levels to some extent. You know, that doesn't completely get in the way of that, but it breaks down the barrier there, where it's saying, you know, okay, you must be really good at the strategy game and constantly thinking about the strategic stuff, even while you're in kind of side view tactics mode. And that's something that one of the things we really battled with Valley 1 was complexity, and just things not being apparent on the face of themselves to the players. And we wanted something that was surface accessible with Valley 2, but also deep. And yeah. We felt like too much marriage, you know, in there, where there's just unseen things affecting, you know, the part of the game that you're in that aren't really apparent on the screen or on any of the HUD elements, you know, that would just be really confusing. That's something that requires a player to build up a really detailed mental model, yeah, in excess of your average strategy game even, and have all that in mind. And if they've, you know, step away for a few months or something and forget the state of either their current game or the details of all the rules, then they come back, they pretty much have to start over, because they have no hope of resuming their game. So, I mean, those were our reasonings behind all of that.
And I think that's a really good point I didn't think about, with how there's that fine line between making, like, if you do make it more connected, between making the system so vital that if you don't get involved with both, you're going to lose, or if you do get involved, it just makes a game, it just breaks the game due to how easy it is.
Right. And that's, yeah. And so, I mean, it's inherent that kind of when you bump two genres together like this, there's going to be a little bit of a disconnect. But, I mean, you know, we took ActRaiser as really kind of the model. If we wanted, you know, I didn't find, ActRaiser was really fun to play through once for me. I didn't really enjoy the side view portions that much, but I enjoyed the idea of them. And the city building stuff I did enjoy quite a bit, but it was so simplistic that once you play through it once, you're kind of done. And so I was like, one of our core things we set out to do was like, let's make kind of a version of ActRaiser, but that is a lot more fun in the side view and is, you know, a lot more replayable on the strategic portion, mm-hmm, you know. And, you know, to that extent, it sort of follows that model.
Mm-hmm. Another point that I wanted to bring up with you is regarding the equipment concept.
Uh-huh.
For those of you who haven't played, in A Valley Without Wind 2, you find equipment in treasure chests during the side view exploration. and the equipment is randomly generated. And a lot of the equipment has, you know, a few positives with negatives to balance it out, and there seems to be very few that are just pure positive. My question to you is, what was the design decision to make it so you could only have one piece of equipment at a time, as opposed to building your building a character or a set of equipment for them?
Well, in terms of character customization, the thing to remember with this is that this is not an RPG remotely. It's not trying to be an RPG. This is basically a Contra-like, or in some respects kind of Metroidvania game. So in terms of our side view progression, we ignored anything remotely RPG-like with the exception of the fact that there are levels, and went with, you know, okay, how would we do this if we were making a Metroid or a Castlevania game? And one of the things that's really common in, like, RPGs is having that sort of equipment that you're talking about, but that's just, it's not even the same genre that we're talking about here. And what the equipment really represents in Valley 2, it was something that we added in as kind of a late addition, relatively speaking. It was not in our initial design doc, and it came in sometime middle of alpha, or, well, before our alpha with other players. But, you know, so it was in the first public build to the game, but it came in partway through our internal builds. And the concept behind the equipment for us was not really equipment per se in something that you keep long term, but it's kind of a temporary bonus. And so, you know, it changes how you play the game for a little while, and then it breaks after a short amount of time. And it's essentially a bonus system. So, I mean, that's really all that it was set out to accomplish. And if, you know, if we were setting out to make an RPG or an RPG style progression, obviously that would be pretty lame. And the fact that there's equipment at all or levels maybe makes some people think of an RPG. But I mean, really the gameplay is more like Contra or something of that nature more than anything else. It's kind of a bullet hell shooter, you know, and that's really where the gameplay comes from more than anything else. And some of the, you know, there's some Metroidvania influences as well, but that's even kind of an iffy thing because there's not the backtracking and so on. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is that with the side view, overall, it's based around player skill versus avatar skill. And that's one of the core things that's different between an RPG and a Metroidvania or a Contra game. And so there could never be anything that lets your avatar get unwieldy out of skill range, you know, to where you're basically overpowered or where you can grind and then get an advantage. We never, ever, ever wanted to encourage people just to go farming stuff. And so with all those things in mind, that makes it so that we do have a progression system, which is true of like a Metroidvania game or something too. But in Metroidvania, the progression system is used for gating, not actually really like actually making anything easier. Actually, the more equipment you get, the further you can go and the more difficult things get in those games. Here we use a little bit of stuff for gating, like with the robotic, with the feats and stuff you can get from the robotic research facilities, but in the main, the focus is on kind of keeping up with the Joneses. So you've got goals in the strategic side that if you don't tend to in a timely manner, your character is not going to be as good as they should be. So then you wind up with an avatar weakness situation, and your skill has to go up even more. So that's another one of those things you have to kind of balance against your strategic goals of, am I keeping my player avatar up to snuff so that things aren't becoming inordinately difficult for myself? And equipment is something that you can use to kind of balance that out temporarily if you find yourself in a hole. And, you know, that was another reason why we'd added that, is it's kind of, temporary bonuses let you shift around stuff for a little while if you run into a particular problem spot. Anyway, again, a long-winded answer, but it's just kind of a matter of we're looking at two totally different genres and we're thinking about these mechanics, I think.
With the strategy side, one of the things I noticed that the followers themselves don't really, they basically remain static outside of lowering or raising their power value. During the design, have you ever thought about, I guess, giving them more, I guess, of a personality or more of a growth as game as time goes on?
Yeah, we actually started out with that. We had a system in there in the early. This is one of the things that did evolve, but in the opposite direction of what I guess you were thinking, is that early in the game we had a system where survivors had skill, and it worked a lot like in Rebuild, actually. In our first beta versions, that's how things worked. But what we found out through playtesting is that players would... having the skill that worked in the Rebuild sort of fashion meant that survivors would go up in skill every time they did a certain kind of mission. So there was a really big incentive to keep all of your survivors together, which is actually counter to having a good strategy game, which Rebuild is a very different kind of strategy game, and your survivors don't have physical position. So it works brilliantly in Rebuild, but not so much here. And... So that was one problem, but the other problem was once you wound up with some really like supercharged survivors, then it was an incredible blow if those guys got lost. And also, you'd run into situations where your like super builder or whatever would be on one side of the map, and you need to construct something quickly on the other side of the map. So then it's like, okay, calculated in my head, if I take 3 turns to get this guy over there, is that going to be faster to build this thing than if I just put, you know, this guy who stinks at building over there and have him build it? And it's like, oh, well, I better bring Super Builder Bob from all the way over there, all the way over here. And so there was just this situation that was created where the number of moves per strategic turn was really unpleasantly high if you were trying to play optimally, where you had to fiddle with your survivors a lot in order to move them around, versus if they have less personality, like more a board game, for instance, then there's not a situation where you have to move this specific guy to this specific location, which means that you are more often than not encouraged to leave survivors where they are, because that's how they, you know, scavenge or work buildings or do whatever it is they're doing, and only move them when you actually need to change your strategy. And that was one thing that we really wanted to do, was have players not having to fiddle endlessly every turn in order to, you know, affect their will, but instead just express their will and assume it stays the same until I tell you otherwise, and then, you know, just basically... give orders for the diffs, and that's something that cut the amount of actual interface, amount of time spent managing the interface down vastly for each turn, and it's more about thinking about what you want to do and then doing a couple of things and moving on.
And that actually goes back to XCOM, or at least the recent remake of XCOM, where since everyone only has one life, in some cases, it doesn't even make sense to keep playing. If you have a really bad mission, you lose all your super high rank guys by accident.
Yeah, I could see where that would be. I can't really comment since I haven't played the game, but I could see where that would be game ending. Based on player feedback, we went through, obviously, a lengthy beta, and we actually started, I think, with it being a little bit more difficult than this, I want to say. But at any rate, the difficulties went through massive revisions throughout our beta period, just in terms of exactly how those were balanced. And, we basically went by how many reports we were getting of people getting frustratingly overwhelmed with the defaults, and we wanted to avoid that. And we figured that advanced players, by and large, would think to turn up the difficulty versus, you know, new players that are getting absolutely stomped in the early game are just going to stop playing. Right. It's tricky because we knew very well that if the main difficulty was too low, that it would make the game seem shallow. But it's So we did go a little bit on the hard side, where the default difficulty is still something that if we had gone just purely with all the player feedback, it's a little bit more difficult than perhaps would have been warranted if we weren't trying to set it out as being kind of a hardcore game. But the more familiarity you get with the game, if you're already an advanced player, gamer in general, the more inappropriate that default difficulty becomes. And there's a setting in there where you can change it partway through your mission. You can do it right under the manage character thing on the world map. And there's actually, in the default difficulties, we did this in Valley 1 as well, in the difficulty dropdown, there's a thing that says on, I think it's Adept, it's like, it labels that one as the default, and then under the one that's Master Hero, it says best for experienced gamers. So we figured that if people, you know, actually click on that at all, that they would see, this is best for experienced gamers, I'm an experienced gamer, let's try that. And then they're going to get their butt handed to them at the beginning if they start their first time playing that way. But, you know, it's tricky. And as a reviewer, you know, a lot of people are just going to go with the default. So we kind of had to roll the dice on that. And, you know, that's tricky because it's, I don't think there's any one way to please everybody with the default. I don't know. I'm not sure what I would do differently.
Back to what you were talking about with balancing the difficulty, the different difficulty levels of the game.
Mm-hmm.
As a designer, do you find that people who are like playtesting or who generally play the game, are they more willing to raise the difficulty level to challenge them, or are they more willing to lower it to make it easier for them? Like,
that's a really hard question, actually. And there's been a lot of discussion, I know, amongst other game designers and so forth in the past. As a general answer, I think most people play on the default when you're talking about a generalized gamer.
Yeah.
That said, our audience tends to be the hardcore niche player.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be really willing to turn up the difficulty to whatever the highest thing is. And if you think about, you know, your average first-person shooter player, you know, that's into the hardcore shooters, not like, you know, pick your casual shooter. You know, one of the first things they do is go and look and see what the difficulties are and crank it up to the highest or one down from the highest, probably. And they, you know, that's evidenced a lot of times by the fact that they really complain when the highest difficulties have to be unlocked. They're like, you have to play through the game once on not the highest difficulty before I get the higher one, you know. So that's, and that's something you see with, like, strategy players as well. And so in those sort of environments, like with AI War, we've had no trouble getting players to go to difficulty 7 out of 10 by default, you know, because the word on the street is, you know, the real game begins at 7, and people go to that and get their butt handed to them, and some of them go, well, I think I'll go to 6, you know, I'll see how it does at 6, and then we'll see. And, you know, it depends on how many times they play through it. If they play through it and win once, we've seen with AI War players, they very much graduate from a 6 to a 7, and then a 7 to a 7.3 or 7.6, and then eventually up to an 8. And then some of them even get up to like a 9 or a 9.3. But, and then some of them just stay on 6 forever, and they're happy, and it's not maybe as challenging, but goodness, you know, I play on 7 on AI War, and I probably could play on 8, but I just find it, you know, pleasingly challenging without being like rip my hair out difficult all the time to play on 7 instead of 8.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's, depends on, you know, what do you really want to play as well. Maybe it's not quite what you could do at peak performance, and what you actually want to play on it all the time is not necessarily the same thing. And I very much respect that.
Yeah.
You know, I play a lot of shooters a little bit lower than I, you know, probably could. But anyway, so with that hardcore demographic, they seem to kind of adjust to taste when they have any sort of baseline whatsoever to go based on. And so with that, that tends to go based on either them having played it before or somebody else talking to them and telling them, you know, hey, this is probably what you should play. Or in our case, saying, you know, expert players play this. This is the default for newbies or, you know, whatever. And I think that for a less, so I mean, that's part of why we went with something that would be a little on the challenging side, but not too stressful for some, you know, for the default, because the people that are kind of in the mass audience are least likely to actually change the difficulty. And so that's something where it's like, well, if it's difficult, that's good. But if it's like super frustrating, that's bad. And if it's super easy, that's obviously bad too. Yeah. So it's kind of like, let's try and strike it so that it's just a little bit difficult and they feel challenged and work their way into it. And the first few turns of the game start out extra easy anyway. So hopefully people play it and realize, hey, this is fun before they start getting their butt handed to them anyway. Because there's like half as many enemies and stuff on the first couple of turns, and they do way less damage. And then it, by turn five, it's ramped up to the full number of enemies and they do more damage and stuff. So there's this kind of a grace period on those first five turns. So that was another way that we kind of combated things for the, you know, default. For the larger audience to try and, you know, draw them in and let them get somewhat comfortable before we're really whipping them. And then for anybody that's, you know, hardcore gamer, hopefully they saw that thing in the menu or go, this is easy. And, you know, Arkane is known for making difficult games and ones that have a lot of depth and challenge. So hopefully our reputation in general precedes us and people, generally speaking, would think, let me turn up the difficulty and see what happens.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, with somebody who's on a somebody who's on the clock for review, that's, it's a different thing. Cause you're trying to get the average person's experience, but you're not necessarily the average person, and that's it's such a catch 22.
Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm still not sure what the absolute right answer is. I think we're in the ballpark, but it's, I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely like a big debate I hear among a lot of gamers if playing on higher difficulty levels should award the player in some way differently than playing on normal, or if the reward itself is just the challenge. And I think there's a really great discussion for that, but I think that may be a little bit too big for this podcast.
Yeah, in our case, the thing that we went with was there are some special achievements for beating it on higher difficulties on the strategic and the action side independently, and that was kind of our way of, you know, your badge of honor of I did this, and beyond that, and we do that with AI War as well, but then beyond that, we don't go with like new content or stuff, because obviously there's been some real backlashes against, like, I think Dungeon Defenders, wasn't it, that had like nightmare difficulty or something, and it was, I mean, you know, keeping people from part of the game because they're not good enough, you know, with like part of the content is something that has been a negative. That's obviously, like you said, a huge topic. But that was our approach to it in brief.
All right. So we're going to move on now to talk about Arkane's next title, Shattered Haven. Now, last time you were on, you talked a little bit about the game, about some of the general elements. How has Warp been going on that project?
It's been going well. We should be hitting public beta with that either possibly late this week or else next week, and we're going to be at a 1.0 within about a month. So we're kind of winding down on that. I mean, there's more to do, but you know, the content and so forth has been coming along really well, and now that I'm not working constantly on Valley 2, I've had time to get back in and implement some of the new technical features that I wanted, like the new lighting model and some compositing and stuff, and of you know, graphical assets, just some other things to help performance and make the visuals better, and yada yada yada. So
yeah.
It's exciting because this has been in work for me since 2008, so it's really exciting to see this one, you know, coming down towards the end.
And for the people who are just like tuning in or aren't too familiar, could you just briefly go over what is Shattered Haven about for them?
So Shattered Haven is a game that is set like 9 years after essentially a zombie apocalypse. So the world has stabilized, and your characters have been kind of hiding out, and they wind up having to go on this kind of journey to try and save their kids. based on events that happen early in the game, and it plays kind of like a cross between like Zelda 1 and Lode Runner. And the idea is that there's all these greys, which are the kind of sort of basically zombies, but they're a little different in the game, and you have to take out all of them in order to get through the level. And there's a whole bunch of levels that are connected together between, I think it's 9 different overworld sections. There tends to be about 7 main levels per overworld section, plus some bonus levels. And overall, there's in the neighborhood of around 100 levels. So, but it's got a kind of a horror story vibe with it. It's suspense slash horror. It's not like gory or anything at all like that. So it's not a, you know, but it's very dark. And it has some ways that you can play through. There's multiple paths to take, and you can get different endings and so forth based on what you do. And there's a lot of interesting replay value with that, and this also will come with the level editor as well, so that players can make levels and share them as well. And yeah, it's top-down like Zelda and looks a lot like kind of a higher-res Zelda 1 in terms of the perspective and so forth that it uses, and has like trap, environmental trap-based mechanics like a Lode Runner game does.
Now, with Shire Haven, this game, as you were talking about, is going to be strictly linear. That there's a set amount of levels. How does it feel going from a design point of view, going from a game like available without Win 1 and 2, where you basically give the player a lot of freedom in how to play or what their goals are, where to go, and moving to this more linear-type design?
I think that both have their place. I wouldn't choose one over the other as my sole way to do business. You know, I at the moment, because we've been doing so much procedural stuff for a long time, I'm really happy to be working on this mainly just for a change of pace, because it really means we can craft an extremely tight experience and something that's a lot more narrative focused and so forth, and say and that really just brings out all the best things in handcrafted levels. And this is the first game, this was actually the first game that I worked on before Arkane even existed. It goes back to 2008, but we've become really known for, you know, the procedural stuff since then, since AI War and Tidalis, and both Valley Without Winds have so much procedural stuff. So in some respects, I guess I almost feel like it's a little bit, look, we can do this too. We've been able to do this all along, by the way, but now you actually see we can do this. And it's definitely a departure for us, but I think it's a really, it's a nice change of pace for us.
Yeah. As you were talking about earlier in the podcast, how Arkane's titles are mostly aimed at the hardcore or the more challenging gamers, is Shire Haven, like, how do you view the difficulty curve for Shire Haven? Is it going to be something more accessible or more like hardcore end?
How should I put this? Well, you know, we have always multiple difficulty levels in what we do, and Shattered Haven is not such a genre mash. There's not any other games that are quite like this, but it's also one thing, which is something you could say is true of AI War as well. You know, it is a strategy game and it is nothing else. It's several kinds of strategy game, but it's not a strategy game and some other completely other genre. And so, to some extent, you know, mechanically speaking, you know, AI War is more accessible just to get into and do around. People don't, you know, an existing strategy game player doesn't really need instruction on how to move the, you know, all the different stuff there. But the AI War has a steep learning curve because of how self-directed it is. So if you take it in those terms, Shattered Haven is a lot more accessible because it's not self-directed at all, and everything is handcrafted to, you know, like a good Metroidvania game or a good Zelda game or whatever to bring you along as you start. That said, the actual game itself, in terms of how much skill it requires, it's a pretty hard game if you play it on... There's four difficulty levels. There were three. We were defaulting to the middle one, but I added a fourth one yesterday, actually, because... Like, our QA guy and so forth kept going, man, this is hard. You know, he kept getting game over so much. I was like, okay, he's a good gamer, and if he's just constantly getting killed, it was basically to the point where, you know, if you knew how to play the level already, then you could just go and bam, 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 bam. You'd, like, execute all the things you needed to do and execute your tactics for how exactly you'd solve the level, then... fine. But if you, like, dawdled around too much in most levels, then you had no hope. You were just going to get killed. And so the default difficulty is now the second one out of four. We call them easy, cutthroat, murderous, and possibly impossible are the names of the difficulty levels. And those are accurate. It defaults you to cutthroat. It's reasonably difficult on cutthroat. I think for me playing it, I find it a little bit on the easy side, but we're just now getting ready to where we're going to be starting private alpha and then going into beta, so we'll tune as needed. I still think it's, for new players, probably a little on the hard side, okay, which is in the ballpark of where it needs to be. Murderous is, you know, you probably don't even want to play that until you've already beat the game once, because it's lives up to its name. And possibly impossible also lives up to its name. I'm not 100% sure you can actually beat the game on that, like, physically. I'm just not sure that it's even possible. That's, like, mechanically speaking. Even if you play on easy, though, it's a really interesting game because this one is really cerebral as well. You asked about how it is to do a game that's more directed, and it's true this one is a lot more directed. I mean, the players have to do this certain set of levels in a certain order and so on and so forth, but the levels themselves are kind of self-contained tactical situations, and there's usually an intended solution that we have, and sometimes that's, you know, really straightforward, like, you know, pick up spears and dodge all the zombies and hit them with the spears, and that's pretty much all there is to it, and that's easy. It's just, you know, Twitch difficult, but not conceptually difficult. And then there are ones that's like in a classic adventure game, it's like, okay, get the bucket. Now, put water in the bucket. Okay, now take the water over here. Now, once you have a pool of water, now go get the bear trap. Okay, now, you know, and it goes like that, and it's like, okay, well, there's one thing that you can do that is the way, you know, the solution that we've found, but there's often several solutions that we've found. Like, if you set this tree on fire first, then it is this. If you set that tree on fire first and then have the lantern, then this, you know. And so there's various ways to solve the puzzles that we're aware of in some cases, and there's also various ways that we probably have not encountered that players can come up with. And so there's an interesting tactical thing there. And one of the ways that we kind of reward that is that there's basic completion, where if you just win the level by killing all the grace, then you can move on in the game. But there's also these kind of secondary goals that if you accomplish them, then you get a gold star on the level. You can also compete for high score in the level on your game. And that involves, even on the really simple puzzles, where it's like throw a bunch of spears into a graze on the default, like if you're just trying to complete it, there's, you know, a little bit more to it when you are going for a gold completion. So there's replay value built into all the levels because they are mechanically robust, I would say.
Yeah. And I think you talked about on the last podcast how I think there's like a new game plus or multiple endings.
Yeah. New game plus is something that... we'll let you go back through and just see the things that you had skipped. So since there's basically two main paths in the game, and I won't say where it branches because it's a little bit hidden, actually. But out of the 100-ish levels, you really only have to play about 40-ish to beat the game once. But if you play through a second time and take the other path, there's another 20-ish levels that are completely different from the first time you played through that you have to play in order to beat the game. And then there's all the various bonus levels that you can find and so forth that are where the rest of those 100 come from. And, yeah.
Sorry about that.
And now I just lost my train of thought from that. Damn.
I don't know what that was.
I'm on the 20th.
Well, I'm on the, first of all, I'm on like a high rise, right? It's the 29th floor, and whatever that was on the street must have been like tricked out to like all eternity. It must have been like two trucks on top of each other. It's going. Anyways.
All right. Okay, now I remember.
Okay.
So with Shatterhaven, as we talked about, Oregon is famous for post-content support. Do you have any plans, like, already for expanding on Shatterhaven after its release, or, you know, like, or moving on to another project afterwards?
With Shatterhaven, the plans are that if it has a certain baseline good reception from players, then what we're going to do is start an expansion for that pretty well immediately, and that would be something that would come out, you know, later in the year after the summer or something. We also are working already on an unrelated project in tandem with finishing Shattered Haven right now, called Exodus of the Machine, which actually that's the first time that name has been uttered outside of Arkin staff, so so you guys are the first to know. But then also, following Shattered Haven, I will be working on a game called Skyward Collapse, and so if Shattered Haven is received well and is, you know, getting a expansion in the works shortly after coming out, then we'll be working on basically three projects at a time at that point. If not, then we'll be working on two projects at a time. And, you know, we're expecting to have, I think it's 8 projects total this year to come out, if I recall. I can't keep them all straight at this point because there's a lot coming in the future.
So you're basically going to be busy for the next year or two at this point.
Yeah, all of those are just the ones we're going to finish this year, though. So, I mean, okay. we're you know, continuing to work at our existing rate, but rather than working on such gargantuanly huge games as AI War or Valley are, and really Shattered Haven is pretty darn big, too, we're going to be working on kind of more mid-sized games that are mechanically deep and thus, you know, have a lot of good replay value off of that. And, you know, we'll be able to sell those cheaper as well because those are things that take us less time to build. And there are things that, you know, are using our existing code and engine and stuff that we've built up, plus obviously new code, but, you know, we're not having to do large-scale engine development at the same time that we're doing, you know, actual development and design of a game. And since we have a, you know, partner art studio that we're accustomed to working with now, that also really saves us a ton of time because, you know, we're able to utilize them versus having to do a bunch of that stuff in-house and then get it fixed.
All right. Kent, do you have any other questions from you?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. I think we can wrap it up then. All right. So I would like to thank Ken and Chris for being on the podcast this week.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Great talking to you again. And congratulations on getting A Valley Without Wind 2 out.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
And for those who are listening, you can check it out from Arkin's website. They have demos for all their games, including A Valley Without Wind 1 and 2. And as we talked about, if you do buy either Valley Without Wind title, you'll get the other one for free. Alright, so we're going to wrap it up here. I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and we will talk to you next week.